Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. The Limark Technical Net meets every Sunday night at 8 p.m. The TechNet's been around for 40 years, mostly under the care of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key a few years ago. And in his memory, we continue it every Sunday night at 8 p.m., and you're all welcome to join. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you the usual links to be aware of. Okay, if you need to reach me and you can't do it via the radio, then email is a good choice. That would be either if you wanted to ask a mailbag question, you couldn't get on the radio. Some people do ask questions via the chat room, which we'll get to very soon. But if you have any mailbag questions, or if you have any topics that you would like to discuss, or you would like to discuss with other people on the technical net, or you would like to hear me babble on about it, that's an option. Another is if you have a technical puzzle. I have one or two in my little pouch that if I have time tonight, we'll investigate and see what we could make of these puzzles. But I could always use more to fill the pouch. So that's another thing. And in addition, if you need me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a NASA or space-related story and comment on it. So my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Of course, if you want to email Paul directly, you can reach him via spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, I have a whole bunch of interesting articles, some of which perhaps we will discuss tonight, many of which we probably won't get to. And there are some articles space-related that Paul might be discussing as well. So the links are available on my link page. They're available 24/7. Just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring up Roy's link with all the interesting articles. You can read them at your leisure throughout the week if you're so inclined. We also have a chat room that I mentioned earlier. You can go to Limark's own website, find the link, and click it, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. I have an audio stream for those people who occasionally Echolink, unfortunately, drops audio. So if you're having problem with the audio via Echolink or you're out of radio distance, I stream it on the Internet. You type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. I maintain it. I try to maintain it 24/7 as best I can. Occasionally the computer needs a reboot, and so I might drop the stream, but for the most part it's there. And also want to remind people of my KC2NJI's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv. Again, amateurradio.tv has archives of the Limark Technical Net going back to September of 2006. He's had over 1 million visitors, so when you get a chance, take a look. There's a lot of archive technical nets from very smart, clever amateur radio operators who have moved away from the area or become silent keys, so their wisdom remains in the recording, so avail yourself of them. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I guess I timed out the repeater. Who would have thunk it? Well, you guys know my KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv, the archive site. And that's probably all that got cut off. Anyway, tonight's plan is pretty much the usual. I was hoping that we would have Andy's mini corner tonight, but he rescheduled for next Sunday, so I'm certainly looking forward to that. So put it in your calendar for next Sunday night. Andy is going to give us a new mini corner. We'll be accepting questions as per usual of a technical nature. I would prefer if the first few questions are amateur radio related, but as the night progresses and we run out of amateur radio topics, we'll accept any science questions. I will try my best to provide an answer or some indication of how to find an answer. Including medicine, as always, we do not diagnose nor treat. But if you have a general medical type question, you can ask it. I have a few little puzzles. If we have time and I feel that the audience is in a puzzling mood, I'll offer the puzzles. That should take us to around 10:15 when Paul will bring us the SpaceNet report. That will go for about 11 o'clock, and I will return and wish everyone well and call it an episode. So that's my plan. If the universe allows me, my computer, the radios, the repeaters, all the things that have to work in order to make it so. With that in mind, anyone with any technical questions tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Rich, W2BZ.
John, November 1, wherever, Quebec 1 uniform. November, Quebec 1 uniform.
November, Quebec 1 uniform. Can I have your first name again?
First name is John, J-O-N.
Okay, very good. Rich and John, recognize anyone else who want to put your name on the list for tonight? If you have any questions or topics or comments or have stories to tell of a problem that you brought to the technical net in the past and you resolved it and you want to share the solution, any of those things, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay. Hopefully, as time progresses, there'll be more questions. Rich, W2BZ, what's your question or your topic for tonight?
Well, I actually have three questions. The first one is, when you calibrate a VNA, what exactly are you doing? And why do you have to recalibrate every time you move frequency? I think you have to recalibrate every time you move to a different set of frequencies. So what actually are you doing to the VNA?
Okay, the last time we discussed VNA, I got an email from someone who was asking me why I'm having an electrical engineering course on the radio. So we'll kind of keep it simple, that it sort of depends upon the way that the VNA is designed and operated. With nano VNA, they seem to be very cautious and suggest that if you turn it off and turn it on, even though there's a memory setting for calibrations, if you change any settings, it's always a good idea to recalibrate the equipment. Now, the way that it gets recalibrated is you test it under three load conditions. One load is a short, so effectively 0 ohms impedance. The other is an open circuit, so infinite impedance. And the other third is 50 ohm impedance. I have other VNAs where the requirements don't sound that stringent. They pretty much say that if you're going to change the length of wire that you're using or some other thing that you want to null out the transmission line that's going to your test equipment, you should recalibrate, but they're not as fastidious. So hopefully that's sufficient. I don't think many people want to know how the internal circuitry of the VNA deals with calibrating for the values. But there are three values, as I said. There's the high value, there's the low value, and there's the average value that amateur radio operators are interested in, their transmission lines and transmitters are designed to work through that impedance. So I hope that provides enough of an answer, Rich.
Well, I think it has something to do with the number of points that you're measuring. So if you're measuring 100 points, you have to calibrate it for 100 points. I don't know. Like I say, sort of confused about, you know, like you said, you know, some DNAs, they tell you that you don't have to recalibrate. So in other words, if I'm looking at 144 megahertz to 148 megahertz, and then I want to go and take a look at, you know, UHF, at least with the nano VNA, they say you must recalibrate. And if you answered it, I still don't get it. I can't conceptualize what you're doing actually when you're recalibrating the thing. What are you telling it to do?
You're giving it a known three-point calibration set of readings. You're telling your VNA that for the present mode that it's on, the frequency range, I don't think the number of points that it captures affects the need to recalibrate it. What that simply does is use a lot more power and kind of limits your abilities and improves your numbers by non-averaging. If you have less sampling rates, you then do a lot of averaging, and if you have sharp peaks or valleys, you lose them in the rendering of VNA. But what you're doing, the VNA is measuring impedances. So you're giving it three known impedances. You're giving it an impedance of zero, you're giving it an impedance of infinity, and you're giving it an impedance of 50, which is the rough area that you're most interested in. You want to see when your equipment is running at approximately a 50-ohm impedance. So you're giving it known, calibrated, high-quality, accurate impedances, and adjusting the values accordingly. The software internally is going to go into that 50-ohm calibration standard and get a result and say, okay, what number do I have to use to calibrate it and bring it to 50 ohms of impedance? Same for zero, same for infinity. So it then selects normalization numbers so that the standardized calibration values are reasonably accurate. And hopefully, if you've made the high point, the low point, and the important 50-ohm impedance point accurate, the curve should be relatively accurate along with it.
Okay, so what you're saying is you have to tell it what 50 ohms is, and what an open is and what a short is, that I could understand. I think I read that the nano DNA is only capable of a resolution of 100 points. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding. It's a function of the hardware design, and it can only sample to 100 points. You know, there might be future versions that are up, but I think that's the present limitation of the design.
Okay, I think I'm getting closer to understanding it, Roy. My second question is totally different area, but as you know, I'm trying to come up with a magnetic loop that works on 20 meters. I'm just concerned with 20 meters. And so I just hung up this loop this afternoon in my living room, and even though it was upside down and the inner loop was hanging down outside of the main loop, I did reverse it so it's hanging the way it should hang. But I noticed, and this is on 80 meters, that when I put my hand on the inner loop, the coupling loop, the radio got much louder, and the signal, I mean, I'm talking like 30 dB louder than it was if I wasn't touching it. So I know I'm providing a ground, but what's actually happening, like, impedance-wise to the radio for it to get much louder when I touch the inner loop?
Well, also for the audience who didn't benefit from seeing the image, Rich sent me an email of the image. It sort of looks like a figure eight with a small loop at the bottom. So effectively, his coupling loop is not situated inside the loop, or at least not the image that he sent me. So what you're doing is you're coupling yourself to the driven loop, and then that increased space is coupling to the magnetic loop area. So you're improving the coupling coefficient of the driven small loop to the larger magnetic loop. That's because it's really not located in a great position. If you want it to be inductively coupled, you should have it inside the circle. Now, there's a sweet spot that is different for each different magnetic loop. So, you know, people do kind of move it a little bit up towards the center or a little bit down away from the center, and they find that sweet spot within the bigger loop. But if you're going to have your driven element inductively coupled and it's outside of the main loop, it's not going to give you a great deal of coupling coefficient. So that's probably what's happening when you grab it, that you're improving that coupling that's kind of dubious at the point that you showed me the picture of it.
I didn't state it correctly. I said that I put it in the inside. I redid it. In other words, from the picture that you saw, I redid it. And as I was doing it, as I was putting the coupling loop inside the big outer loop, I noticed the radio got much louder. So I guess I'm providing the ground for it, but I don't know, and I guess you want to stay away from scientific stuff, I don't know, but how is my body coupling with that inner loop, making the radio much louder and the signals more prominent?
Well, when you're grabbing the small loop, you're capacitively coupling with it, unless your hands are very wet, and you're just improving the coupling between the two loops. I don't think it's a function of grounding it. If you were to take that driven loop and actually grounded it to an earth ground, you'd probably have a diminished signal. Because it would go to ground. So I don't think you're grounding it. I think you're simply offering it a greater opportunity to do some more both inductive and capacitive coupling. I think if you try and adjust the distance away from the center of the big loop with the little loop, again, there tends to be a sweet spot for the inductively coupled driving element within the larger magnetic loop. It's not all the way at the touching the magnetic loop. It's not at the center of the magnetic loop, but someplace in the middle tends to be the best part for inductively coupling. And that should be sufficient.
Okay, I can understand that. The third question is, and I sent you a picture like 2 seconds before the net started, so I know you couldn't post the website, but I sent you a picture of an air variable capacitor, and the reason why I sent it is because, as you see, there are two sections to the capacitor, and I thought I could isolate one section out, but I can't. You know, I took different measurements with an ohm meter, and no matter where I measured from, both sections of the capacitor, they're identical, but both sections of them come into play all the time. So I was just wondering, I forgot where I got it, because it's been a couple of years, but is there a way for me to measure exactly how much capacitance, the value of the air capacitor?
Yeah, you have a VNA. VNAs measure impedances. They measure reactants, and you can calculate given the frequency, what the capacitance is. So yeah, you could do that with a little bit of math and a VNA.
Comment.
Yes, Wesley, you have a comment.
Trying to play devil's advocate. How do you know that he's improving capacity reactants? Maybe he's worsening. How about the aperture? How about the area of influence? Is he enlarging the area? How is the area versus capacity reactants measured or eventually represented into X-ray?
Okay, usually if you look at a standard magnetic loop, the variable capacitor is at one end and the inductively coupled coil is at the other end. So, you know, unless you're kind of grabbing the thing in a strange way, most of your coupling is going on with the driven element, not the variable capacitor at the top of the magnetic loop. So although anything's possible in this world, I think most of the effect is taking place at the level of the coupling between the magnetic loop and the driven inducting loop.
Capacitive reactances are in opposition to AC, so series or parallel reactances are combined in the same way as the resistances. How do you know if you're touching it and you're adding your capacitive reactance, how that circuit reacts? Is it because of enlarging the area, or is it because of adding additional reactance to it? And to X-ray.
Personally, I would think the overwhelming reason is that you're increasing the area of the coupling. I don't think holding on to a coil, you're kind of introducing a lot of capacitance to the driven coil. So my and primarily the way that the driven coil is coupled to the magnetic loop is primarily inductive. So I'm just assuming that that's what's giving the overwhelming change in the amplitude, as opposed to introducing a couple of picofarads of capacitance to the antenna system.
Okay, I'm trying to hold my devil's advocate speech. The total reactance X is equal to the difference between the two total reactance X equal XL minus XC. Capacitive reactance SC is larger at low frequency and small at high frequency, and it is known as capacitive reactance. A question is, again, does the capacitive reactance depend on aperture, the area, or just the area, or just the conductance between your body and the object that is in resonance and to X-ray?
I'm not quite sure what the question even is. You're not conducting. You're just coupling. So, unless you kind of put your hand in salt water and then start to play with the antenna, for the most part, it's more of a capacitive coupling to the inducting element. Because I don't think he's really holding or touching much of the magnetic loop itself. It's the driven element that's physically separate, that's being inductively coupled to the main magnetic loop. where probably most of the effects are being caused, that when he holds on to it, he's coupling it and he's increasing the surface area and interacting with the coupling between the two loops. I don't think he's introducing a heck of a lot of capacitive reactance to the tuning circuit of the magnetic loop. And the driven loop doesn't have a tuning circuit. So, like I said before, I don't know for a fact because I've never really tried that experiment, but I guess people could. I think most of it is purely the capacitive coupling. You know, like anything else, people in the old days when we had rabbit ear antennas, and you walked over to the antenna and you didn't touch the antenna, but you put your hand about 2 inches away from it, and the image looked a little bit better. And, you know, if you were the youngest person in the family, it was your job to stand there in front of the rabbit ears. I think it's sort of along those lines that we're talking about.
The capacitor's role is to absorb the energy, correct?
Well, the job of the capacitor is part of the resonant circuit of the loop antenna. With the loop inductance and the variable capacitor's capacitor, they both work in order to attain a resonant quality, which possibly might be one of the puzzle questions later on if we have a chance. But capacitors store charge, yes, but they're part of a resonant circuit in the case of a magnetic loop.
The inductive reactance rises with increase of frequency and capacitive reactance falls. Both are similar to resistance as measured in ohms. So if I touch it barely, it's the difference between if I touch it strong, then you would say the conductance is important here. That's what I was trying to say. But there is another moment. Because inductive reactance rises with increase of frequency and capacitive reactance, also what is true for capacitive reactance at one frequency is opposite and different. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's sort of the basics of a tuned circuit.
Okay, so now I was trying to keep my statement that area is important. Area is important. It's area that does it. Not, okay, that was my point. Entwexia.
So when you increase the area of the capacitor, you're increasing inductance, is that right, Roy?
Again, not quite sure what that question means. What do you mean by increasing the area of a capacitor? I don't quite understand. If you use a lot of your body surface to come close to an object, you're going to have more capacitive coupling just because of the nature of things. Capacitance is a function of the dielectric constant, the distance between two conductors, and the surface area.
Yes. So if you have a body of an inch, you're not going to increase it. So area is important. That's the area that does the trick. And you have more of capacitive inductance here, because influence of your body is bigger on the circuit than influence of the ant body on the circuit. Entwexia.
Okay, so once again, if you have an ant walking on your rabbit ear antenna, you're not going to see any better reception. Whereas if you have a human being, that can have a lot of capacitive coupling. I won't go so far as you can tune an antenna with a person's capacitive coupling. because I don't think that you can do it that way, and it's probably a dangerous way to tune in an antenna. You know, you'd have to have some guy standing there and touching it and getting RF burns all the time. So, as I said before, I think that this is just a consequence of just coupling to the driven element and coupling from you to the driven element and from you to the magnetic loop. And since you're not going to be standing around the magnetic loop, your best approach is to optimize the coupling without you of the driven element to the magnetic loop.
Roy, I think we doubled, but let me ask you this way. What is the purpose? What is the purpose of the variable air capacitor in a magnetic loop antenna?
It is part of a tuned circuit. Antennas are inherently tuned circuits. Without the tuning capacitor, it would not have it would not be a resonant device, and you would not be able to efficiently receive or transmit. So you need to introduce the variable capacitor in order to tune the resonant circuit to be resonant at the frequency that you wish to transmit at.
The outer loop exactly, you know, using the formula, if you cut the outer loop to exactly, let's say, 14.1 megahertz, you really, and that's where you're going to park your transmitter and receiver, you're not going to move from 14.1 where you cut the outer loop to 14.1, you really don't need the capacitor in that case. Is that correct or not?
No, that is not correct. If you do not have a tuning capacitor or something that acts as a capacitor, there are magnetic loops that instead of having adjustable tuning capacitors, they have these big metal plates with a means to adjust the distance between the two, and that sort of acts as a crude, limited variable capacitor. If you do not include a capacitor of some kind in a magnetic loop, it will not be resonant at those short frequencies, at those short lengths. If you have a full wave loop, which is no longer a magnetic loop, you do not need a capacitor. It is resonant by design. But magnetic loops are anywhere from 10% to 30% of the wavelength. So you have to do something else to tune that type of a circuit.
Okay, I got it. It's all about the resonant circuit. But isn't a magnetic, I'll ask just one more question. Isn't a magnetic loop resonant at one frequency without the capacitor?
I guess so, but it's a frequency that's 10 times higher than you would want it to be, most likely. Again, it would be for a full wave loop. So consider the circumference of your loop in meters. That would be the band that you would be able to communicate without a capacitor through.
These half wave or quarter wave antennas, the ones I'm talking about.
A functioning full loop antenna is a full wave antenna is a full wavelength. So in other words, if you wanted to have a 10-meter full-wave antenna, you would need something with a circumference of 10 meters. That's difficult to keep in the air. You can build one for 2 meters. That's much easier, and 70 centimeters is a lot easier. But that's a full-wave loop. They have different radiation patterns and different characteristics than a magnetic loop has.
I got it. That answers my question. So, thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, Rich. I hope it helps. John, NQ1U, what's your question or comment or topic for tonight?
Hi, thanks. This is NQ1U. Yeah, I've had the luxury of having places I could put up antennas for my ham radio career. I no longer have that luxury. I'm in an apartment on the 12th floor in Manhattan, and I look at all sorts of wonderful metal structures around me called buildings. So right now I'm using my limitations of 5 watts right now, and I'm using an N9PAX NFED Slim Jim. So the question is, this is much more mundane than the other question. I'd appreciate comments on what antennas I can get or even build myself that might be more efficient when just stuck on a window in an apartment building. Thanks.
Okay, what kind of bands are you most interested in?
2 meters and 440.
Well, okay. There are people who like Slim Jims. My understanding is they're modified really J-poles where you kind of fold over an extra half wavelength of radiator. The takeoff angle is a little lower than a J-pole, so elevation is a little bit more important in a Slim Jim than a J-pole. Both of them, you know, I mean, some people love them. Other people don't really like them that much. They feel that they're not as efficient as they would like. I know people who regularly use a mobile magnetic base antennas, and if you have a air conditioner and such on the outside of your apartment, you just kind of stick it onto the metal casing. And depending upon the surroundings, that might be a tolerable solution. Anyone else with any good ideas of types of antennas for apartment use? Feel free to hit that push to talk.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
Good evening. I had a setup for 220. I bought a Hustler mobile whip, and I attached it to an NMO mount on the air conditioner, not outside, but inside. And I was able to get about 3 repeaters on 220 in my area. So I don't know if that's good.
Okay, I mean, I would recommend, if at all possible, to keep the antennas outside, both for isolation of RF from your shack, and you just have a better possibility of signals. You're going to get some degree of attenuation from walls. I mean, unfortunately or fortunately, my walls are the old standard chicken wire and plaster. So they're regular Faraday cages, but other people who have similar, you know, they'll put it right next to the window. But if you could put a antenna either outside or inside, I would go 100% put it outside. Don't put it inside. Those mobile antennas, they're basically shortened verticals with loaded induction coils that tend to be inefficient. When you're going to something like 2 meters and 70 centimeters, I don't think it requires that much wire. That you probably should stay away from loading coils because although they're good in mobile environments, you don't want to bang into a tree or a garage ceiling or something. For the outside, having a full-length antenna is probably the best approach. Anyone else with any good ideas of 2 meter and 70 centimeter antennas that are appropriate and that work well for an apartment?
A question.
Yes.
This is JD2UAH, Roy Rocco, and the group. Two questions. I'm just curious if David had ever done an SWR check, because I have had a similar setup like that, too. And sometimes the SWR I found is a little high. I was wondering what his experience was, and that was the first question. The second question also, you mentioned about, you know, not putting things inside. I'll let it drop. Is there any formula that, you know, based on the frequency that you can measure a safe distance of where you can put an antenna? Because I have a similar problem in that I have to put antennas inside or in the attic where the shack is. I can't really put anything outside. Back to the net. Thank you.
Mine work better inside.
Okay, that's a kind of an unusual thing that it works better inside. Again, some of it has to do with what's in the walls. My walls are chicken wire, so it really doesn't work inside. But some people don't have that type of structure, so they might miss some kind of thing that's blocking them right out the window, where when they put it on the wall, it goes through whatever is in the wall. There are many programs available, Rocco, about RF exposure because the FCC changed their rules that all good amateur radio operators in the next 3 years have to do an RF assessment of their shack. The ARRL has a page where you can plug in the gain and the power and the frequency of your equipment and get an approximate value, and you can look up to see, you know, how dangerous that might be. We even put one up. I forget exactly where I put it, but I remember I put it someplace. It's probably listed in my link pages, but certainly the ARRL has a page where you can do calculations based on frequency. As the frequency goes up, the danger goes up. As the power goes up, the danger goes up. As the gain goes up, the danger goes up. As the distance between you and the radiating antenna goes down, the danger goes up. So you can plug all those things into the equation and get a rough approximate risk assessment.
A question again, Marissa, KD2UAH.
Yes, Rocco.
Right now, for example, on HF, I would use a loop, like when I use one of those chameleon loops inside. Now, with any of those loop antennas, you have to, you know, unless you have a rotator, you kind of have to sit just about next to the antenna because you're always playing with it, you know, because of the fact that you have to constantly tune it as you change the frequency. So basically, you're very close to the antenna. That's my concern. But again, this is, you know, 10 meters or another HF. Back to you,
Ryan. Yeah, the frequency is significantly lower, obviously, than 70 centimeters. So it's less likely that you're gonna roast your eyeballs. Also, with magnetic loops, most of the time I found people who are adjusting the tuning network are looking straight through the hole in the donut, and that's the closest thing those antennas have to a null point. More of the energy is going off to either side. So although it's still not a great idea to pump out too much RF too close to you, probably the limitations inherent in a magnetic loop, unless you're buying a vacuum, a variable capacitor, is not going to be much of a problem. When you think of cell phones are significantly higher frequency. They're a reasonable amount of watts, but really the kicker is they're right next to your face. So, you know, in terms of the difference between 4G and 5G frequencies and the antenna being smack dab against your face, and the magnetic loop being 10-meter transmissions, and it being at least a couple of feet away from you, kind of would make me a little bit feel safer. But you can still plug the numbers in and see what the numbers tell you.
Okay, thank you very much, Roy. Thank you to everyone in the net.
You're welcome, Rocco. So once again, anyone else out there with any good ideas of an antenna for an apartment? You know, if you have one of those little if you have a fire escape, that's a good place to put up a larger antenna if you wanted to. Or if you have a balcony, you might have an opportunity. But, again, if you just happen to have a air conditioner that goes through the wall or through the window, I would just stick a mag-mounted version of a good full-size mobile antenna. I think probably that would be the most efficient way of doing things.
KG2R1.
Yes, David?
Roy, I have a friend. He lives in Germany. He ran a wire around his apartment where the wall meets the ceiling. And he set it up for 15 meters, 20 meters, and 40 meters he had to use a coil. And then he added another coil for 80 meters and then a little bit more wire. And he played 40 or 50 watts on CW. And he was able to make many contacts.
Okay, you can do that. And there are people in this area that have been known to do that. I recall more than a few stories of people who tacked up wire on the upper portion of a wall and ran it as far as they could through their house. You know, if you happen to have walls that are radio transparent, if you don't have a lot of RF-sensitive equipment in your house, then it certainly is an option. You know, any antenna that works, you know, any port in a storm. So any antenna that works is a decent antenna. I said, as I mentioned before, all things being equal, if I have the option to have an internal versus an external, I find less problems with an external. But for those people who simply have no way of doing an external antenna, and they don't have the limitations that I have, that I live in attached housing, so right next to my wall is another wall and a house, and then another wall and then a house and then another wall, and plus that the plastering is chicken wire, it certainly would not do anything for me. I remember way back when I got my first receiving antenna, it was a magnetic loop, and in the house it was worthless. I couldn't hear anything. I took it out to my backyard, and it was much, 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 much better. But your mileage might vary.
To try a vertical dipole, try to make a vertical dipole and tape it to the edge of your window, see how that works. I did that. I took two mobile whip antennas and attached them to a hamstick dipole mount. And I was able to make contact. The antenna was inside the apartment.
Okay, yes, a 2 meter, 70 centimeter dipole is certainly a thing that you could accomplish. Takes up a wee bit more space than say, a half wave mag mount, a quarter wave mag mount, but yeah, that's an option as well. You know, the saving grace of 70 centimeters and 2 meters is because the wavelength is so short that you don't have to deal with the mechanical complications of larger antennas. You know, pieces of wire will work. Pieces of aluminum rods will work. You could build your own. You can buy one from many different manufacturers. I think there's more than a few options. Again, there are some people who really love J-poles. I think they have kind of gone out of fashion in the last 5 years or so. It seems like 10 years ago there was a lot more talk of J-pole, and people who used to regularly make it out of copper piping and such. But again, if anyone else has any ideas a reasonable apartment-based 2-meter, 70-centimeter antenna. Please hit that push-to-talk button. Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, we are coming to the magnetic antenna concept. And the company, Ametek, which is known for many products, mostly commercial products, they have, if you Google MFC-3, it's an interesting antenna that is standing alone on a vertical post and has two loops which are swiveling on one mount, on that vertical mount, and you can change the position of one loop against the other. MFC-3, multi-turn magnetic field loop. It is 1 and 11 turns. That's what I see right now. I can click, keep reading, and it should open up. Yeah. That's one of the antennas. It's very simple. It could stand on your desk. And it's absolutely nice concept. Did you find it?
Okay, I'm not quite sure. What band is that designed for?
Well, looking at the diameter of it, it says MFC-3 multi-turn magnetic field antenna, one turn with pulse plug included in delivery, 11 turns with powering plug, okay, maximum strength 40 amps per meter, continuous compliant with IEC. It looks like it is the frequencies over 100 megahertz based on what I see there. But the concept about magnetic antennas, the magnetic loop antenna measures the magnetic H field emanating from UT. It is often used for 9 to 30 megahertz, so I'm kind of confused there. Magnetic loop antennas are designed to measure H field and ignore the influence of E field element present within electromagnetic signals and to exchange.
Okay, I mean, I did a search. I found something called Avalon test. It looks more like a stand for an iPad. And it gives no specs, which is very troubling to me personally. So I don't know. I think you could probably come up with at least 20 or 30 kind of better, well-tested designs. And I don't know what to make of this particular magnetic loop.
At the word Ametek, A-M-E-T-E-K, Ametek, MFC-3. Or if you don't want MFC-3, just go by Ametek antennas. Ametek antennas. There's one very similar to it, only with one loop, MFC-1000. Then you have MFC-300. And there is also automotive DC magnetic field kit. So those are precise instruments made for measuring, but they are good antennas.
Well, it would kind of make me feel better if it even mentioned what bandwidth it used. But these things, you know, also it's request a quote. So I find that whenever you're looking at an object and instead of them saying that it's, you know, $35.82, request a quote is like the kiss of death for most amateur radio operators. So I don't even know if this would be appropriate for 2 meters or 70 centimeters. And there's nothing on their page that really, unfortunately, tells me anything useful, which is a curious thing. I very seldom have seen a page with such a lack of useful information.
Well, you are absolutely right. I just got that information, but I was dealing with Amatec before, and it was in particle physics when I was buying their equipment, quite sophisticated and very expensive. But the concept of magnetic loop antenna is simply constructed out of coil of wires, and it's based on Faraday's law. When magnetic field passes through the loop of wires, the coil generates a voltage, and its terminals related to its RF frequency. The operation of the magnetic loop antenna doesn't get any simpler than that, I believe. And because the loop antenna is simply constructed out of coil of wires, it's relatively easy to use it for everyday bumps and bruises when you're dealing with receiving signals, received signals, or even EMC test facility if you have one. And to exchange.
KG2R1.
Yes, David recognized. I just want to make a point. I guess it's a kind of an aesthetic sensibility what you find as the simplest design. I find the simplest design of an antenna to be a half-wave dipole. It's rather clean and clear, and you have a much better understanding. To this day, there are people who argue what's really going on in a magnetic loop. And since a magnetic loop, sort of by definition, is approximately 10 to 30% of the wavelength, if this was operating on 2 meters, it would be a little tiny thing, which it doesn't quite look like it is. So, again, I don't know exactly what it is, unfortunately, the page doesn't even tell you how much it costs, but it certainly doesn't give you any actual specs. I mean, I have never, ever, ever seen an ad for an antenna that doesn't mention what frequency it operates on. But, David, you wanted to say something.
Well, you know, I own a dual-band mobile whip antenna designed with a mag mount attached to it and a wire that comes out of it. And the connector is SMA male. So it seems to work really well with my HTs. And then what I did is I connected it to my television and my digital to analog converter. So now it receives television, both VHF and UHF. And this particular antenna, Comet makes it, Diamond makes it. I think some other brands like Moonraker also makes one.
Yeah, very good. I mean, that's what I kind of started this conversation on, a mobile mag mount antenna. You probably, you know, all things being equal, would want a somewhat sturdier connector on it if you were going to use it as a base station. But, you know, there are converters and all kinds of fun things. But, yeah, that sort of goes back to the first comment that I made, that a mobile mag mount antenna, especially if John, we should really get back to John because I haven't heard from him for a while, whether he has something like a an air conditioner chassis that can supply the ground. Worst case scenario, if you don't, you could always wire up a counterpoise wire and have it hang down quietly off the side of the building. Let me take this opportunity to ask if John's still with us and if he's likes any of the ideas or has problems with any of the ideas.
W2HO.
This is NQ1U.
Yes, John.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that conversation you started. It's just great. No, I have no structures outside the window I could use. I do have an unobstructed window that can handle this half-wave thing I've got here. And what I've come away with is maybe I'll try a cookie sheet inside. I don't know if that's on a mag mount. I used to use that on a car a lot. But no, I'm really confined to inside. And two things that interested me were something else on the window
or perhaps even trying running around the ceiling. That's a cool idea. I think I, like you, Roy, have a Faraday cage for a house, but there's someone else who wants it to come in, so I'll let him come in. This is NQ1U.
Yeah, W2HO, you wanted to make a comment?